So if you walk into a bookstore today and, pick up a translated Japanese novel, there is a very specific vibe you might expect.
Oh yeah, there's
Like
like
a quiet Zen garden,
a okay.
or a quirky cat offering life advice.
Right, or a protagonist having some gentle epiphany in a minimalist cafe.
Exactly. But if you look at the actual history of Japanese fiction, well, beneath that calming aesthetic is 1,000 years of radical, sometimes violent social engineering.
Yeah, the aesthetic we consume today is really just the surface layer.
Right.
When we analyze the sequence of literary systems in Japan, we're looking at a society repeatedly fracturing and rebuilding itself. I mean, the category we even call the novel is historically unstable there.
Wow.
It's been entirely reshaped over the centuries by, shifting writing technologies, totally different readerships, and the collapse of political regimes.
Welcome to the Deep Dive, everyone. Today we're exploring a massive dossier on the structural evolution of Japanese fiction, from the aristocratic courts of the Tale of Genji all the way to the contemporary global bestsellers on your shelf.
And our mission for you, the listener, is to stop looking at this as just a list of famous books.
Yes, exactly. We are going to treat these stories as a map of social transformations. How do narratives actually adapt when the ground beneath them shifts?
Which it does, a lot. Understanding why literature changes really helps us understand the history itself.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really grasp this evolution, we have to go back over 1,000 years to a foundational rupture during the Heian period.
Right, so to understand the literature of the Heian period, which peaks around the 10th and 11th centuries, you first have to understand the mechanics of the language itself.
Okay, lay it on us.
Well, at the time, classical Chinese was the official language of the state. It was a logographic system, meaning the characters represented complex concepts, and it was entirely dominated by elite men.
Wow, entirely.
Yeah, pretty much. They used it for government bureaucracy, legal documents, official histories, things like that. But parallel to this, a completely new phonetic vernacular script developed. This was called kana.
And this phonetic script changes everything, right? Because of who ends up using it, the
Exactly.
women of the aristocratic court.
Yeah, because the rigid official posturing of classical Chinese basically excluded these elite women. So they adopted kana.
Makes sense.
And because kana was phonetic, it flowed much closer to natural speech and thought. It wasn't bound by the heavy formal rules of statecraft.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Right. This allowed women at the court to write diaries, memoirs, and tales that mapped human psychology in a way official documents simply couldn't.
I was thinking about how to visualize this shift, and it feels like the invention of Kana was it was like the release of a revolutionary encrypted messaging app.
Ah, I love that comparison.
Like the men are out there writing the official corporate memos in Chinese stiff, formal design for public consumption, right?
Yes, very performative.
But the women found this new vernacular channel where the interface itself allowed them to post their actual unfiltered feelings. And by doing that, they basically invent modern interiority. They create the technology to write down the inner self.
That analogy highlights the mechanism perfectly.
Yeah.
The writing tool dictates the depth of the thought.
Exactly.
And I mean, the absolute pinnacle of this new interior space is Murasaki Shikibu's The Tale of Genji, written in the early 11th century.
Right. A massively famous book.
Right. It is often debated as the world's first novel, but its real monumental achievement is the sustained architecture of its social world. It meticulously charts memory, political maneuvering, and specifically the extreme vulnerability of women within aristocratic marriage politics.
Because it's definitely not just a breezy romance.
Oh, far from it. What's fascinating here is how the cultural reception of Genji acts as a mirror for later social changes.
Wait, how so?
Well, while these court women built the foundation of Japanese prose, the literary institutions of later centuries became heavily male-dominated and conservative. So for hundreds of years, Genji was championed primarily as a handbook of romantic refinement and poetic grace.
Oh, they totally rebranded it.
They really did.
Yeah.
But if we apply a modern sociological lens to the exact same text, the narrative reveals intense coercion.
Oh.
Yeah, we see women with severely restricted agency being isolated in mansions, subject to the structural violence of a patriarchal system. The words on the page are identical, but the society reading them shifted entirely.
That is wild. And that actually brings us to our next massive shift. We move out of the closed elite world of the palace and jump forward to the Edo period, running from 1603 to 1868.
A huge jump, yeah.
We are suddenly in the explosive commercial streets of cities like Edo, modern-day Tokyo, and Osaka, and Kyoto. And the audience for fiction changes completely. We go from aristocrats to merchants and commoners.
And that demographic shift is entirely driven by a change in media technology, the boom of commercial woodblock printing.
The printing press changes everything again.
Exactly. The Edo period experienced relative political stability, which allowed for massive urban expansion, incredibly high literacy rates, and the invention of commercial lending libraries.
Oh, so everyone is reading.
Everyone. The city itself effectively functioned as an immense reading machine.
I want to focus on that reading machine idea. The sources detail a massive category of mass entertainment called gasaku, or playful writings. It sounds chaotic in the best way.
It really was.
It mixes moral instruction, heavy eroticism, biting satire, and pure visual spectacle. Authors like Ihara Saikaku are writing rapid-fire prose about urban appetite, money, and status.
Yes, Saikaku's work is crucial because he treats the city as an engine of desire. In his stories, a person's social type is defined entirely by what they consume and how they navigate the pleasure quarters or the merchant exchanges.
Just like modern consumerism, kind of.
Very much so. And crucially, publishers realized they couldn't just sell dense blocks of text to this new consumer class.
Right, they needed visuals.
Exactly. They integrated text and illustration so tightly that the physical typography and the visual art are an inseparable narrative experience.
Okay, I have to push back on something in the research here, though.
Oh, go for it.
A lot of modern critics look at Edo woodblock culture and draw a direct line to today's transmedia franchises like, you know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe or modern Japanese manga culture with its fast plots and cross promotions. I just struggle to see how a 17th century woodblock print compares to a modern transmedia empire with lore bibles and spin-offs. Surely they weren't doing that level of world building.
Well, actually, the historical record suggests they were doing exactly that, just with analog technology.
Wait, seriously?
Seriously. Edo publishers essentially invented the serial accumulation of lore. They produced multi-volume epics with recurring characters, spin-off merchandise like standalone prints of fan-favorite heroes, an elaborate crossover event.
Oh my gosh, so they really were doing the MCU in the 1600s.
They really were. They proved that a commercial audience could sustain massive, intricate narrative architectures. And interestingly, a massive driver of this complexity was government censorship.
Ah, so the complexity was a survival tactic.
Exactly that. The Tokugawa shogunate frequently issued edicts banning the depiction of contemporary political scandals or even the luxurious lifestyles of merchants.
So how did they get around it?
They developed a technique called mitate, which is a form of visual and textual layering or displacement.
Okay, how does that work?
So if a prominent politician was involved in a current scandal, the author wouldn't write about him directly. Instead, they would write a story set hundreds of years in the past. But the illustrator would draw the historical figure with the distinct facial features or the family crest of the corrupt modern politician.
No way. So it's an inside joke with the entire city.
Yes, exactly.
The censors can't officially ban a story about a 12th century samurai, but every merchant in the lending library knows exactly who is being mocked.
It was an incredibly sophisticated ecosystem of parody. Readers were trained to read on multiple levels simultaneously. But this highly functional, playful media ecosystem faces a catastrophic shock in 1868 with the Meiji Restoration.
Right. The borders open, the shogunate falls, and Japan races to modernize and westernize at breakneck speed.
It was a massive upheaval.
They reorganized their government, their military, and their class structure almost overnight. And what strikes me is that as the nation violently expands outward, the literature turns violently inward.
That is a great way to put it. The Meiji period wasn't just an industrial revolution. It was an attempt to fundamentally re-engineer the human subject.
Re-engineer people.
Yeah, Japanese intellectuals were suddenly translating Western texts and grappling with concepts that didn't neatly map onto their existing society. They had to invent new vocabulary for concepts like society, romantic love, and most disruptively, the individual.
Wait, they had to literally construct the concept of the individual?
Well, in the context of Western individualism, yes. The previous social order was highly communal and role-based. Suddenly, writers were introduced to Western psychological realism, and it induces a profound cultural vertigo.
I can imagine.
Natsume Suseki becomes the defining voice of this crisis. In his masterpiece Kokoro, which translates roughly to the heart or things of the heart, he meticulously details the isolation of a modern intellectual.
Right, he's a very famous author from this time.
Yes. Suseki's characters are paralyzed by guilt, ego, and the moral ambiguity of rapid progress. He captures the tragedy of the modern divided self, cut off from tradition, but alienated by the new, cold institutions of capitalism and bureaucracy.
And the sources show this crisis giving birth to a genre called the iNovel, or Shisetsu. Writers like Shiga Naoya championed this form, which basically insisted that the author's actual lived experience was the only guarantee of truth.
Yes, sincerity and extreme self-exposure became the absolute highest aesthetic goals.
And here's where it gets really interesting for me if we look at the psychology of it. The iNovel functions exactly like the ultimate, raw, unfiltered vlog on the internet today.
Oh, that's a good point.
You know, you have an author performing their flaws, insisting, look at my messy life, no filters, I am bleeding on the page, so you know I am being sincere.
Yes. The mechanism of the iNovel relies entirely on the audience believing there is zero distance between the author, the narrator, and the protagonist. It's an assertion that despite the alienation of modern society, a pure, authentic self can still be transmitted.
But then you have Akutagawa Rinosuke coming in to completely dismantle that idea.
Oh, he absolutely tears it apart.
He writes stories like Rashomon and In a Grove. And In a Grove is brilliant. It's the story of a samurai's murder told through multiple entirely contradictory testimonies, including the victim speaking through a medium.
Right, and none of them match up.
None of the stories match. It's like Akutagawa is the cynical filmmaker pointing out to the audience that every vlog is highly edited. He structurally proves that objective truth and the sincere self is inaccessible.
That tension defines the era. Shiga Naoya believed transparency could save the modern soul. Akutagawa demonstrated that transparency is always an illusion.
Wow.
The literature is obsessively asking, can individuality even survive in a society that demands conformity? But this intellectual crisis is eventually overwhelmed by a physical
war. What? The war?
Exactly. The anxieties of modernization crash directly into the catastrophic reality of the Asia-Pacific War, total national defeat, and the American occupation.
Looking at the sources, it's wild to see how the lead-up to the war polarized writers to absolute extremes. We should clarify, we aren't endorsing either of these views, but just reporting on what was happening. You got fierce Marxist proletarian literature on one end, like Kobayashi Takeuchi's The Crab Cannery Show.
Right, a very famous left-wing text.
Yeah, which diagnoses the brutal exploitation of workers fueling the capitalist state. And on the other end, you have authors leaning into ultranationalism. It's fascinating just looking objectively at how these entirely opposite political ideologies use the exact same tool, the novel, to push their worldview.
And in 1945, the imperial ideology completely shatters. Post-war writers had to invent a language to process national collapse, atomic trauma, and the immense burden of historical guilt.
That is a massive burden for literature to carry.
It really is. One immediate response came from the decadent school, most famously Dazai Osamu. In novels like No Longer Human, Dazai rejected the government's push for wholesome, optimistic reconstruction.
He was not having any of that optimism.
Not at all. His protagonist, Obayozo, is profoundly alienated and uses constant clowning and self-destruction as a defense mechanism against a society he views as entirely hypocritical. Dazai elevates failure and shame into a powerful anti-hero narrative.
And the debate over how to define post-war Japan eventually reaches the global stage, perfectly illustrated by two Japanese Nobel laureates with radically different approaches.
Yes, this is a defining contrast.
You have Kawabata Yasunari, who wrote Snow Country. His work focuses on a highly aesthetic, melancholic vision of Japan geishas, frozen landscapes, the classical beauty of impermanence.
Very beautiful traditional imagery.
Right. But then you have Seiken Zaburo, who actively countered Kawabata. A described an ambiguous Japan. His books, like A Personal Matter and The Silent Cry, are visceral.
Very visceral. Yeah.
They confront physical disability, the grotesque messiness of bodily reality, the violence hidden in rural villages, and direct unavoidable war responsibility.
And if we look at the far extreme of the aesthetic argument, we find Mishima Yukio.
Huh?
Mishima developed a theatrical, militaristic nationalism tied to an obsession with absolute physical and classical beauty.
Which ended terribly, right?
Yes. It culminated in his highly public ritual suicide in 1970.
Which makes me want to ask a really probing question about how literature functions. If we look at Kawabata's beautiful, snowy landscapes, or Mishima's intense obsession with perfect physical aesthetics, can beauty actually be a dangerous thing? Does a strict focus on aesthetics risk covering up the ugly, complicated truths of history?
That is a fantastic question. If we connect this to the bigger picture, you've just articulated the central debate of post-war Japanese letters.
Really?
Yeah. How do you ethically represent a history where the civilian population experienced catastrophic victimization, the firebombings, the atomic bombs, while simultaneously the Japanese Empire was perpetrating immense violence across Asia?
That is such a complex tension to hold.
It is. And Ken Zapruder's fiction is so powerful precisely because it refuses the comfort of pure beauty or pure victimhood. He makes memory a formal, structural problem for the reader to solve, forcing them to sit with the grotesque contradictions of guilt.
It is incredibly heavy, necessary work. But as our map continues into the contemporary era, the structural conditions shift yet again.
Always shifting.
We move past the dizzying heights of the 1980s economic bubble and arrive at the Japan of today. And the landscape of the novel has entirely transformed. We are looking at a society dealing with precarious gig work, severe demographic decline, the dominance of digital platforms, and the lingering trauma of the 2011 earthquake, tsunami, and Fukushima nuclear disaster.
Right, when the myth of lifetime employment and perpetual economic growth collapsed, the literature had to pivot to diagnose the new precarity.
It had to adapt again.
We see a significant blurring of the old boundaries between highbrow, pure literature, and popular fiction. Writers like Miyabi Miyuki use the mechanics of crime fiction and procedural mysteries not just to tell a thrilling story, but to expose the systemic traps of consumer credit, identity theft, and modern urban poverty.
You also have Murakami Haruki, who achieved massive global success by blending a cool, detached pop culture vibe with deep, surreal investigations into historical mourning and missing people.
Yes, Murakami is huge globally.
But looking at the contemporary sources, what absolutely dominates the landscape today is the power of women writers fundamentally changing the setting of the Japanese novel.
That spatial shift is critical. Writers like Kawakami Miyako are bringing bodily discipline, reproductive expectations, and working class struggles directly into the philosophical center of the narrative.
Right.
And Murata Sayaka's convenience store woman is a perfect example of this new spatial reality. She uses a deadpan, highly observational logic to expose the intense, almost violent pressure of workplace conformity and traditional marriage expectations.
I love that point about the spatial shift, because when we started this deep dive, the drama was happening in aristocratic courts.
Yep, the palaces.
Then it moved to the gentleman's study in the Meiji era, or the snowy provincial inn. But today, those romanticized spaces are gone. The primary battlegrounds for the modern soul are the 24-hour convenience store, the sterile corporate call center, and the tiny rented apartment. That's where the actual drama of modern survival is taking place.
Exactly. The contemporary Japanese novel is at its most potent when it focuses on a protagonist who no longer fits into a socially prescribed role.
Like when they just drop out of the system.
Yeah. When traditional gender expectations feel like a trap and the nuclear family structure breaks down, authors invent brilliant new frameworks to make sense of the isolation. Take Ogawa Yuko's The Memory Police.
Oh, I've heard of that one.
She builds a dystopian sci-fi island where everyday objects, birds, roses, photographs are systematically forgotten, and a secretive police force enforces this amnesia.
Wow, that's dark.
It is. What stands out to you, reading a premise like that, is how she uses extreme speculative fiction to perfectly capture the quiet, subtle coercions and everyday losses we all experience under modern state control.
It's chilling because the speculative elements just feel like a slightly exaggerated version of our actual reality.
Absolutely.
And alongside these thematic shifts, we are finally seeing the dismantling of the old myth that Japan is a perfectly homogenous society. The canon is actively being expanded by marginalized voices.
It's a very important shift.
You have Zainichi Korean writers like Yumiri exploring the brutal legacies of colonialism and citizenship. There is a resurgence in Okinawan literature and Ainu oral traditions. And you have translingual authors like Tawada Yuko, who writes in both German and Japanese, treating language itself not as a fixed identity, but as a border that can be crossed and manipulated.
These authors are proving that the Japanese language and its literature is plural, contested, and highly reflective of a complex globalized demographic.
So what does this all mean for us? We've traced over 1,000 years of literary history today, and I think the defining takeaway from this massive stack of sources is that Japanese fiction is not some static, unchanging essence of cherry blossoms and samurai.
Definitely not.
It is a living, breathing record of structural trauma and transformation.
Precisely. Whenever the underlying social architecture fractures, whether through a new writing system, the shock of Western modernization, total war, or the collapse of the modern economy, the literary system inevitably invents a new form to process the fallout.
It's fascinating.
And this matters deeply to you, the listener, because the themes animating contemporary Japanese fiction are not isolated to Japan. The crushing isolation of urban life, the anxieties of technological surveillance, the reality of precarious gig economy labor, these are global fault lines.
Yeah.
We're all currently living on them.
We really are. And that brings me to a final thought I want to leave you with. A bit of friction to mull over next time you are browsing for a book.
Oh, I like where this is going.
Right now, global audiences are eagerly consuming translated Japanese fiction, and very often the publishing industry packages these books with incredibly cozy marketing. You know, the covers of a cute healing cat, a quirky cup of coffee, a pastel minimalist aesthetic.
Right, they all kind of look similar.
Exactly. But if we only consume these books as cozy, exotic escapism, are we completely missing the devastating critiques of modern capitalism, isolation, and social control that these authors are desperately trying to warn us about?
It's a really good question to ask yourself.
Next time you pick one up, think about it. When we look at the map of Japanese fiction, maybe the ground beneath our feet isn't as solid as we want to believe.